Lars Blarzner, amateur wrestler and boxer in better times, fought with a confounded sword that seemed forever out of his control. He now put all his energies into staying alive. He finished off the royalist with a sudden lucky stab and looked for an opening between thrashing horses and battling men. The back of the other worlder, known as Kelvin, turned toward him. As usual, the hero of another place battled three royalists with his shield and his sword, handling both brilliantly. He chopped off a hand of the royalist in front of him, swung the sword back, and slashed the eyes of the man to his left. He seemed hardly to look, as if he knew exactly where his opponent stood without having to use his eyes. In the meantime, the swordman on his right stabbed him, not quite touching him, but severing the leather thong that held the Muvar weapon secure against Kelvin's leg. The Muvar weapon! It fell. It fell down there in the dust. While Blarz wiped sweat and dust from his eyes, Kelvin finished off the third of his three attackers with an expert stab. But ahead, the way cleared before the gates. Then a billow of dust hid even Kelvin from him. Blarz had no time to speculate. He must get the Muvar weapon while he could. Get the weapon and get it to Kelvin. Without it, Kelvin couldn't continue to win. None of them could win, unless he could manage to use the weapon himself. With sheer brute strength, Blarz reined his huge warhorse over to the spot. Blarz turned his attention to ground under the horse's hooves. He reached, grabbed, and had it. He stared dazedly at what he held. He had heard so much about it, yet he had never seen it in action. It looked strange, a device that resembled a crossbow only in the most superficial manner. It had a bell-shaped muzzle, one would point at a foe. The part that fitted the hand fit like the hand grip on the smallest of crossbows, the kind used mainly for games, for children to train with. There, a strange dial set in the device with two odd marks and a little fin shape pointed at the higher of the marks. Without thinking, Blarz turned the fin shape to the lower mark.
Flop ears! Flop ears! Flop!
Realizing the battle continued while he wasted time, he urged his horse out into the dust. Now, he could make out the figure of Kelvin sitting oddly still astride his warhorse. Riding hard down on him, standing upright in a small saddle on the back of a gigantic warhorse, sat a small figure with upraised sword. A flop ear, about to kill Kelvin. Blarz hardly knew he pulled the trigger while pointing the weapon. He felt the slightest recoil, saw the spark. But was that all? As he watched the flop ear swing down, he saw Kelvin save himself and his horse with some amazing maneuvering. Freedom fighters who stood stationary in the dust resumed their motions. All kinds of action occurred where a moment ago none moved but the flop ears. Blarz looked at the weapon in his hand. It must have worked. The flop ears still fought, but no longer against frozen opponents. How a weapon could bring folk back to life instead of making them dead, he hesitated to guess. Certainly, this was nothing for him to gamble with. Concentrating hard on the deed at hand, he maneuvered his horse, bypassing fights when he could, and working steadily closer to Kelvin. The movement of the gauntlet surprised Kelvin as never before. It shot up, grabbed the swiftly descending blade, and wrested it from the flop ear. The flop ear lost his balance, toppled from the saddle, and fell under the war horse's pounding hooves. He could move. The stasis spell broke.
Here, Captain, you lost this.
A large, swarthy freedom fighter held out the Muvar weapon to him, using the rank given to Kelvin. Something about the man's face instantly bothered him. With supreme shock, he realized this was the near duplicate of the pointy-eared guard of the notorious Franklin Girlmart, who forced himself on Helm.
I lost it, and you used it!
I saw one of those three last men you fought cut your belt with a sword. Your horse did some jerking after that, and the gates fell, and the flop ears appeared. I got the weapon for you because I knew you'd want it, and had it in my hand, and you were frozen then. So I tried it, and now you're unfrozen. And I brought it to you. I don't know what I did with it, but I guess that they worked somehow. You're the hero, not me. You know how to use it.
Kelvin took the weapon from the big man's hand. He had to say something, and he fought to get it right.
You're the hero! You, not me! Thank you for saving me and for returning the weapon I should have guarded with my life.
Captain, the war's not over until they lower the flag on the palace.
I know.
After a startled intermission, the fight continued. Delvin saw no frozen warriors, neither freedom fighter nor royalist. Mortal freedom fighters now fought immortal flop ears hand to hand, yet the battle seemed to be turning. Just as before the flop ears appeared. Now, looking around, he could see more green-clad soldiers on their mounts than red-uniformed royalists. The battle must rage. The war must continue until the flag lowered. Would it come down? Kelvin did not know. Zanan got to her feet, wiped her face, put her robe in order, picked up the ring of keys she had been carrying, and resumed her journey to the dungeon. John and Kyan stood at the bars as she descended into their gloom. Both shone thinner than she had last seen them, worn by the days and the nights of harsh confinement. Dark half-moons shone beneath their eyes, reminders of more than sleeplessness. After Smith finally died, the neighboring cell stood empty. The young man looked at her with widened eyes, swallowed.
You look so much like...
Hush now!
She inserted the big key in the lock and turned it, knowing that they washed.
Your ordeal is over and your victory all but won. The freedom fighters are at the gates and winning back the land. Your brother Kelvin is in their very midst, a hero to base legends on. Soon, very soon, it will be over.
Thank the gods!
Looking at the Muvar weapon he held, Kelvin saw that the knob on the butt had been turned, possibly when it fell. Could a different setting account for the fact the Floppiers were not themselves the victims of their own stares? He wanted to see them frozen into statues as the serpent. If he moved the knob to its former place, would that cause it to happen? It was worth a try. He twisted the knob and raised the weapon just as another Floppier rode at them with suicidal fury. He pulled the trigger, wondering whether he should be raising his sword instead. The horse and Floppier stopped, frozen, as if by the staring paralysis. The mortals and their horses continued to fight. The fight could continue with the Floppiers out of it. But would it?
They're giving up!
Kelvin saw the big man pointing. There, above, they could see the silver and gold flag creeping down the pole on the palace roof. This meant surrender. Finally, totally, unconditionally. As he looked toward the palace, past the gates, two men and a woman awaited him.
Father! Kyan! We've won! We've won! We're going home again to those who love us! Home! Home at last!
But Kyan, though released from a dungeon, looked as if balanced on a precipice. His face, already pale from imprisonment, paled perceptibly more.
Home. That's very good. Really wonderful.
Well, cousin, it's over. The good mortals won.
Yes, won well, as planned, though the Muvar weapon cost us.
Did it, cousin? Good members of our band?
Your enemies, Herzig, though not acknowledged as such. Those who wanted to go with Rowforth and share his triumphs. Those who wanted to be rulers of mortals in this and other lands. Was it fair, Herzig, giving them what they wanted?
Fair is a mortal concept. Call it just. They wanted to fight for Rowforth, and they fought for Rowforth. Now, slain or not, they will never again be involved in a mortal's fight.
True. You're very old, Herzig, and very wise. You prove the wisdom of a saying mortals have.
Yes, cousin, and that is...
Wily as a serpent.
Kyan could not understand why he felt as he did. He was going home. Home to the girl he wanted, and always had wanted. Why, then, did he feel more his execution at hand?
I'm going to miss you, Kyan. We will all miss you. But I know that I will miss you most.
I know.
And now he wished she was the girl who would be his bride. But the right girl had pointy ears. Not too long ago, Lani wouldn't even have looked desirable to him. No, the right girl had to be the one at home. It hurt, but somehow it must be right. His mother knew the right, hadn't she?
Goodbye, Lani. Goodbye. If things were different...
I know.
They waited for him. He forced himself to turn away from her and to begin, step by step, what had to be his successful return. But Kelvin and John Knight stood with Queen Zanon, and the older man looked just as uncomfortable as Kyan felt. The Queen turned, her great green eyes bearing on him, so familiar yet strange in their gentleness.
I understand that in your frame my analog was your mother. I've had no children, but had I done so, I would have been pleased to have one like you.
Kyan found himself hugging her, just as if she were indeed his mother. They emerged from the chamber to discover John and Helm waiting. Without a moment's delay, all embraced.
Oh, Kelvin, I had this dream. I think the dragonberries have caused me to dream what is actually happening. I saw all of you back here, so I persuaded John.
There was only one boat here, and that too small for the four of you. Mr. Yokes was kind enough to lend us another, particularly after I explained about the baby coming.
Baby? Baby? You?
Oh, no, you idiot. Your wife.
Helm? Helm? You?
She nodded, smiling prettily in the manner only a pregnant wife could.
You're going to be a daddy, Hero, like it or not.
Kyan pounded his back and shook his hand enthusiastically. Even so, he half hid a reticence to his congratulations, a reticence that registered with each of them. St. Helens tried to shut out of his consciousness the sounds of screaming men and terrified, suffering horses. She might take all their lives, but by the gods, he'd get this witch. Burn a witch alive, he'd been told. By the heavens, if he must, he'd do it. Back in the pass, the avalanches continued, boulders dislodged by the quake, bounding, rebounding, often striking flesh. Great cracks opened like hungry mouths, swallowing men and horses. St. Helens drew the polished, razor-sharp sword the young king once gave him and pressed its cool metal to his lips briefly. Now, he thought, and activated the levitation belt. He cleared the overhang and the three ledges of Conjurer's Rock and disturbed some buzzvoles brooding on their nests. Stunted trees, twisted and gnarled, grew on the sides of Conjurer's Rock as he approached the top. If he stayed preoccupied with her magic, maybe then he had a chance. There she stood, at the very edge of the rock, her black cloak flapping, her arms stretched out toward the pass, her lips making sounds lost in the rumbling of the earth and the cries of brave, good men. Now was his chance. He drifted at slow speed toward her back. He visualized her head bouncing down the rock with her hair flowing. He raised the sword, prepared to sever her neck. A buzzvole screamed above him, and the witch vanished.
Fool! Fool! To seek to destroy me was nothing more potent than an ordinary sword!
Suddenly the air thickened between them, a wall of heavy air pushing down like a wedge of water, forcing him down with his belt.
Two can play at that game.
St. Helens pushed the control to accelerate, maximum up. His body shook, and he felt as though being pressed flat. The trees of Conjurer's Rock grew nearer, and he was in them. Sharp branches like oversized thorns reached and grasped. Wind shook him. Tips of ugly, gnarled branches entered his arms, his legs, his back. The wind took away his scream and left him impaled and mute, a crucified prisoner. The penetrating branches burned with the fire of thistles deep in his flesh. Finally, it seemed a year or two later, he gained some control. His flesh, though tormented, appeared free of vital injuries. He could still fight his way free, and a buzzvole lit at the edge of the rock. Abruptly, it was an old woman with a wrinkled face, a squat body wrapped in a cloak that flew like dark wings on either side. Her hands reached, claws extended as if seeking to grasp the men and horses down in the broken and trembling pass. St. Helens had to see, and for once, cursed his sense of sight. Men and horses fought to get free of rocks heaped upon them. Men and horses and parts of men and parts of horses squashed, broken, ruined. Equipment lanced up through jagged wounds in the earth. Melba, the witch triumphant, raised her hands, palms facing each other. A small spark formed between Melba's stubby fingers, that grew to the size of a grape, an apple, a watermelon. Suddenly a great roaring ball of fire floated just off the rock in front of her stark, disturbing form. The heat blasted back at him, suffocatingly.
Now, St. Helens, you pitiful excuse for an opponent. See what becomes of my enemies? See the folly of defying me? See the destruction you have wrought?
Moore crouched beside a fallen boulder next to a horse's sightless head, the body of the animal buried in the solid earth.
Lester! Lester! Where are you?
Then he saw his son, half buried under his own dead horse. He couldn't know whether he was crushed or unconscious or dead. Moore crawled to him. A figure staggered over to him through the dust. With shock, he recognized General Brotner.
Moore, we're done. We need to retreat if we can scrape up the strength even for that. There's no going to our attacks. The witch beat us. I thought her magic was fake.
They were right about her. She's more powerful than any army. Deadlier even than the sorcerer the Round Ear destroyed.
Stronger than the Round Ear.
Moore winced to hear it, but he had to agree. Zatanna's deadliest magic never equaled an earthquake. And for all the prophecy, Kelvin would be as helpless as they were. How could anyone fight a witch who could make the very earth open up and swallow an army?
He's alive.
General Brotner bent over Lester and looked under his eyelids.
Unconscious.
With his strong hands, the general lifted the dead horse's head. Despite his dizziness, Moore managed to pull his son free. He could see that Lester was alive and might recover with proper care if they could get him home to John in time. But how?
Do we have the men and strength to get the wounded out?
It'll be tough. We'll need help just to retreat. If we surrender now, maybe she'll let us go. I'll get the surrender flag out of the supply wagon, if I can find it.
The general moved off, head down. Moore stayed alone with his son. He smoothed Lester's brow, wiping away some blood and sweat and dirt. They would never get away from here. None of them. The witch meant to destroy every vestige of their army. There was no defeating Melba, no defeating so strong a force. As he looked toward the distant, stubby shape, trying to discern her form, a great brightness like a rising sun formed between him and the rock. A fireball, a great mass of flame. It streaked toward them like a monstrous flaming arrow. Witch's fire, the stuff Moore had heard of, coming to burn them all, to destroy every one of them. On the way out of the underground river to the remains of the old palace, Helen and John filled them in on St. Helens and the affairs of Aretex. Kelvin listened carefully, not revealing too much of what happened after he started out with St. Helens. His anger at his father-in-law burned like a white-hot coal ever since he stepped back into his home frame. Now, hearing, listening to the man's troubles, he could almost rejoice.
I think the three of us had best get to Aretex fast.
Kelvin gave him as cold a stare as he could manage. How did this make sense?
He saved your helm, Kelvin. Surely that must move you, if the insult to your country and your countrymen does not.
Not to mention the prophecy.
You're right, Father. We have to try.
They deposited Helen back at her room in the Rudd Palace. King Rufford greeted them and shook their hands. He made no objection to their leaving immediately for Aretex.
I'm coming too.
No, Brother Wart. Definitely not this time.
I've got better eyes than any of you. I can spot danger before you think about it. Who hit Zatanna with a rock?
Who nearly had all her blood drained? You have to stay, John. It's not right that you...
Chauvinist! Whose man do you think might be in trouble? My man Lester, that's who!
Certainly you can come, John. I'm glad to have you alone. I don't think we could leave without you.
Thus, things settled, as they usually did, when concerning Kelvin's pointy-eared sister. The four of them rode to the river without incident, found the new bridge, and crossed it into Aretex territory. The ride to Deadman's Pass lay ahead, marked by numerous horse droppings and wagon ruts. Just as they reached the entrance to the pass, they heard a roar ahead as the ground shook under the hooves of their borrowed war horses.
Earthquake and avalanche! Lord, if they're caught in that...
It's her! It's Melba, up on Conjure's Rock! She's doing it! She's causing the ground to shake.
You're crazy, Brother Wart.
Crazy, am I? Look, just look. On top of Conjure's Rock, up above the dust cloud, above the pass, look.
Kelvin strained his eyes. So did his brother and his father. From here, Conjurer's Rock looked like a foreshortened tree stump rising above the dust in the pass. Could there be a little ant on the top of that stump, with outstretched arms? John seemed to think so. Kelvin knew his sister possessed unnaturally clear eyesight, but seeing Melba on top of Conjurer's Rock from this distance seemed impossible.
You've got to do something. You've got to, Kel. She'll kill them all. She'll kill Lester.
The Move-On weapon. Use it, Kelvin. Try shooting it at her.
It won't do any good.
Then, recognizing the desperation in his father's voice and his sister's face, he reached for it.
Hurry! Hurry!
He got out the weapon. Just what should he... A tiny spark shone brightly against the top of the stump. It did not dim and go out, but immediately started swelling, moving like a flaming arrow.
It's a fireball! Stop it! Stop it now!
As if he could. Yet all he could do was try. He pointed the Move-On weapon in the right direction.
Do your stuff, Gauntlets!
John's hand lay over his and the gauntlet. Her finger covered the gauntlet finger. The trigger squeezed in a quick, sure motion. Bright light flashed, filling his eyes and head. St. Helens watched the fireball as it receded from the face of the cliff. It grew larger as it flew, streaked with terrible brightness and destructive potential.
Damn you, witch!
Suddenly, almost as if the fireball were responding to his curse, the fireball slowed. In fact, it hesitated. Melba leveled her arms, fingers extended, but to no avail. The fireball reversed course. Now it returned, roaring back in all its fury. Melba did not wait to embrace her creation. The arms became wings. Her body had feathers. She climbed desperately skyward as only a frightened Buzzbill could. The fireball changed direction. It followed her. Melba climbed higher. She zigged and zagged in the evasive action of a bird. But the fireball caught her, engulfed her, devoured her in its flames. St. Helens felt the tree branches loosen. There remained only misshapen trees now, no longer as magical henchmen of the incinerated witch. He pulled himself out of his trap. He had won, or someone had won, though he couldn't figure out how. He must get down there in the pass, see if a magician traveled among them. Somehow, this thing happened, catching him and, gratefully, Melba completely by surprise. Someone there had to know. He reactivated his belt, flew from the rock, and lowered himself down into the pass where the carnage appeared even worse than from above. The witch had nearly finished this army before sending the fireball. He spotted Moore, bent over his son, and suffered a stab of remorse. Was the boy dead? Moore's face lighted as he looked up.
You did it, St. Helens! You stopped her! You destroyed her for all of us!
Lester! Is he...
Unconscious. Not hurt bad, I think. He's a crumb. We crumbs have hard heads.
General Protner, is he alive?
He's checking the damage done back there. There's a lot of it, at least up this way.
Thanks, Moore. I'll be back.
Sean flew up the pass, seeing more and worse destruction the farther he went. Men lay squashed by great rocks. He saw horses half buried. Finally, he spotted the general straining with other men to lift the huge supply wagon off the shattered leg of a mercifully unconscious man. The job accomplished, St. Helens landed silently beside them. The general bore the aspect of a thoroughly defeated man.
The witch is dead, General. She was the main obstacle.
Dead?
She sent a fireball and it turned on her and destroyed her. It burned her to ashes. She is gone, dead by her own magic. Didn't any of you see it happen?
I saw the fireball. I saw it turn, and then it winked out.
And it burned up its creator. What are your plans, General?
Plans? You think I've got plans?
St. Helens made up his mind in that moment. His hands played at the controls on the levitation belt.
Don't give up hope, General. I have a plan.
With that, he rose with the belt, angled his body in flight path past Conjurer's Rock, and took himself down the darkening sky to the palace of the Boy King of Aratex. Once there, he entered the window he left with Helm over what seemed a lifetime ago. The room appeared much as before, and with his careful surveillance and good luck, he believed he had not been spotted. He looked around the room to discover a horrible apparition facing him. He grabbed for his sword, and the other did likewise in perfect synchronization. With a shock, he realized he faced himself, reflected in a mirror, battered and bruised, hair and beard unkempt, blood and dirt on his clothing, hands and face, sullied with bits of leaf and bark from the trees that held him. He tried the door and found it unlocked. The guards had not bothered to lock it after the prisoner escaped. He started down the stairs. If the king stayed inside today, as he did nearly every other day...
Where do you think you're going?
It was Bemode standing at the foot of the stairs, sword drawn. St. Helens drew his sword.
Bemode!
His Majesty himself strode from the playroom and stopped, standing there with red, swollen eyes, but with more than a hint of command in his voice.
But, your Majesty...
Please go outside, Bemode. Leave us alone. There are things we have to discuss.
Bemode looked from St. Helens to his nominal boss and back again. His piggish eyes drifted in confusion, and he seemed to be trying to decide.
That's a command, Bemode.
The man sheathed his sword. St. Helens sheathed his. The man left.
Now, St. Helens' friend, come with me.
St. Helens followed, wondering why. The king behaved as if this return were routine. Inside the toy room looked as always. Toys sat on the shelves, and there stood a table set with a chessboard and chessmen St. Helens himself had made.
One last game, friend. One last, and I won't throw a tantrum if I don't win.
St. Helens brushed some sweat out of his eyes, trying hard to understand the young king's thinking.
You kept it set up just as when we played every night.
Yes, Melba was no good as a player. So please, one last game, and then you can kill me as you plan.
Kill you? Kill you? Why?
The boy's stricken face rose from its contemplation of the chessboard and the chairs.
She's dead, isn't she, St. Helens? Isn't that why you came here? You couldn't have otherwise, not alone. She was watching for you. She had magic telltales set. She would have captured you, tormented you, and then brought you back.
You really think that I... With this sword you gave me?
It is all I deserve, or ever have deserved.
God!
He couldn't beat the kid after this. He had been, in effect, checkmated by a pupil who had learned his lessons better than the teacher. Mor blinked in astonishment as St. Helens dropped from the air with the young king on his back. He started to reach for his sword, but stayed his hand. This was the king, after all, and St. Helens obviously brought him in for a purpose.
Lester, Mor, the fighting's over and there's no more Aratex. My son-in-law's prophecy is going to be fulfilled, with him or without him.
Hello, St. Helens. I'm glad you managed to redeem yourself.
It was St. Helens' turn to blink. Four horsemen stood in wait behind the fallen rocks. He knew they hadn't been there when he had left. He saw before him John Crumb, Lester's wife, John Knight, his old commander and Kelvin's father, Kyan Knight, Kelvin's half-brother, and the fourth, none other than Kelvin Knight Hackleberry, who had just spoken.
Kelvin, can you forgive me for what I've done to you?
Maybe, father-in-law. Maybe when your grandchild is old enough to ask, maybe then I'll forgive you for helping me fulfill the two words of prophecy.
Grandchild? Helm?
He had been told before, but it was almost as if he were hearing the words for the first time. Recent events nearly banished the matter from his mind. The world spun, and somehow it seemed quite natural that he crash-landed on his face with the young king on top of him. He lay there, quite moved, but unmoving. as King Blastmore proclaimed the words they agreed he should.
As the sovereign ruler of the Kingdom of Aratex, I solemnly proclaim Aratex's complete and unconditional surrender to the Kingdom of Rod. And with this, I abdicate Aratex's throne, relinquish all claims, and beg the mercy and forgiveness of King Rufert of Rod.
Helm dreamed, and knew she dreamed. In her dream, a beautiful young woman with long blonde hair and deep blue eyes undressed. With her stood a man, a former queen's guardsman she once saw at the palace petitioning for a pension. The man, too, undressed, his every motion evincing eagerness. Behind them stood a waiting bed.
Must I see this? Oh, must I?
Instantly, she hovered outdoors, outside the cottage sheltering the man and woman. There, coming toward the cottage door, a smile on his face that she somehow recognized as forced, came Cian, her husband's brother.
Oh, poor Cian. Poor Cian.
Then she woke.
Poor Cian. Poor man. I feel so sorry for you, Cian, but there isn't anything I can do.
For though she saw it in a dream, she knew it was not. It was another after effect of the astral separations she experienced before. She had seen the ugly truth. Her life was happy now, but that wasn't enough. Sadder than she had been for a long time, Helm broke down. They finally gathered again in Kelvin's house. The war's over for the time being. They could relax to enjoy family and friends.
Apparently, it's anti-magic.
Moore looked at the Muvar weapon Kelvin showed them.
The way it took the fire back to the witch, and the way you say it stopped the flop ears and the serpents in that other world.
Yes, I figured out that it turns the magic energy back, whatever it is, on the sender. Thus, in the other frame, the hypnotic freezing stare was returned, while here it was the witch's fireball. When the control knob got moved, it merely blocked the magic without returning it in kind. Thus, the flop ears remained a danger, but could not paralyze with a glance. But once the knob was at its original setting, it returned the magic and the flop ears paralyzed themselves.
Hooray for here! Hooray for making Kel use that weapon!
Well, at least you were saved.
Helm, now rapidly approaching parturition and all that it implied, began reciting without the help of wine.
A round deer there shall surely be, born to be strong, raised to be free, fighting dragons in his youth, leading armies, nothing loth, ridding his country of a sore, joining two, then uniting four. You've joined two, Kelvin. Now that the citizenry of Aratex has voted to unite its country with that of Rud.
That means that the next task you face is uniting four. I suggest that...
Kelvin gave him a hostile look, and St. Helens subsided, doubtlessly remembering. They had almost been to blows after Kelvin's timely arrival in Aratex. The tongue-lashing Kelvin delivered on the spot in front of Aratex's young king was more than St. Helens had stood for since his basic training. Now the two shared a tenuous friendship, or at least admitted to their standing as relatives. But Kelvin suspected, and St. Helens knew, that St. Helens felt he should hold a governing position. Kelvin didn't believe in nepotism, particularly extended to in-laws, and the voices of the people would soon speak in the first of the infant country's elections. The new name for Aratex, annexed to Rud, would be Kelvinia, not Helenland, as St. Helens had unblushingly suggested. Cian still looked sad a month after the triumph in Aratex. Everyone noticed it, particularly Helm.
Why so sad, Cian?
Lenore Barley. I don't want to marry her. I want Lonnie back in the other frame.
Well, I could have told you that, son.
You could? Why didn't you?
I felt you'd need to find out yourself. Didn't you notice that almost all the lookalikes had characters opposite to their counterparts? King Rufford, for instance, is mostly kind and gentle, but his counterpart was cruel and delighted in inflicting pain. Cheeky Jack was a contemptible bandit who sold mere boys and girls into slavery. Jack's counterpart is a heroic person, a genuine patriot, and one of the finest men I've met. What does that say to your inherited intelligence, son?
Lonnie, she's opposite.
Right.
When I called on Lenore, she was with someone. A man. An ugly man who had served the queen. It wasn't like Helen imprisoned in the girl Martin, unable to help herself. She wanted him. He challenged me to a fight. She laughed, clapping her hands as if delighted. I walked away. The first time I ever walked away from such a challenge. I didn't want to give her the satisfaction.
What does that say about the nature of your mother? Think back. Her counterpart was as different from her as Lonnie is from Lenore.
Kyan's face clouded, revealing the source of his reluctance to accept the situation.
She's my mother. She's...
probably dead. Now remember, I thought her everything the queen in the other frame is, and she wasn't.
I guess I have to accept.
You'd better, Kyan. There is no real choice. You loved what you felt should be there, just as I did.
Lonnie.
People have some choice whether to be good or bad. Philip had no choice. But if I had had his upbringing, I might have been as bad. Now he's got a chance to be good. And he's going to be. Making chessmen and chessboards with me and having tournaments. You know, the boy has a real talent for chess. Right now, except for me, I'd say he's the world's champion.
But only two of you play that silly game in this world.
No, I know how to play it too. You'll have to go back to get her or stay with her. You haven't any choice. It's like Kelvin and the prophecy. No choice for either of you.
No choice. I'm going back. To live there or to bring her back.
And I'm going with you. There's no way I'll miss attending my son's wedding.
You know, Queen Zinan's a widow now, technically, and...
And it remains awkward for me in Rod, where I'm supposed to be dead. Charlaine
is married to a good man. I don't think she'd mind if you...
That was my thought. I think I need a wife as much as you do, and you need a mother again.
The two exchanged glances, understanding perfectly. St. Helens, wine glass in hand, flush on nose, lurched to his feet.
And don't come back!
There had been a time when that would have been an insult. Kelvin looked at Helen, and then at Lester and John. They nodded. It was the best way to lose a father or a brother. It was a great, fine time in Kelvinia.
Kelvin of Rudd, Book 2, Serpent's Silver, is a graphic audio production. Copyright 1989, Tor Books. Published by arrangement with Piers Anthony and Robert E. Margroff, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2013, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Unauthorized download and or duplication prohibited. Performed by Dylan Lynch, David Coyne, Tracy Lynn Oliveira, Kimberly Gilbert, Lily David, Michael John Casey, David Harris, Joel David Santner, Michael Glenn, Thomas Penny, Stephen Carpenter, Elizabeth Jernigan, Alyssa Wilmoth, Nanette Savard, Ken Jackson, Eric Messner, Thomas Keegan, Terrence Aselford, Patrick Bussink, Drew Copus, Nick DePinto, Christopher Graybill, Bradley Smith, and Gary Tells. Book adapted for graphic audio by Johann Detweiler. Directed by Ken Jackson and Johann Detweiler. Dialogue editing and sound design by Brian Rogers. Theme music by Thomas Hogan. Additional music by Johann Detweiler. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. If you enjoyed Kelvin of Rudd, be sure to look for Christopher L. Bennett's Only Superhuman and The Goblin Trilogy. available at road stops everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll also find samples of all our action-pumped titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts.
Around here there shall surely be, born to be strong, raised to be free.
Mama, why are my ears so small and so round? Why aren't they like yours? Why are they like Daddy's?
Because, my dear, you are very special.
Special, Mama?
Your father is special. That is why you are, too.
But why?
He's from another world, dear. A world just a little bit different from ours. There are many such worlds, many such existences, universes. They lie side by side, touching as the skins touch on an onlyk. Each skin subtly different, yet subtly the same. We can't see the worlds that interpenetrate ours, but they are there, and they are real to the people or beings living there.
You ever hear me tell about the old days? I remember it as though it were this afternoon. I killed round ears with my sword. Did you know that?
I think I guessed it.
Hard to kill, they were. Great fighters. But the worst of it was they had magic. Weapons such as no sane mind ever imagined. Not swords and crossbows, no. Magical.
Tell me.
Explosive thunders that blew apart men and horses. Lightning that struck with a red bolt and went right through men and war horses and good solid armor. It was as if we were weeds and grass before a fiery scythe. Do you understand what it is to face such things?
You say I'm one of them.
You may be one of them, son, but you haven't their magic. But you will have, won't you?
I don't know.
Don't kill him!
I never saw anything like that move. You just grabbed my blade right out of my hand. You must be.
You better believe it.
Oh, that hardly seems fair. Magic?
You prate of fair? You who attack nearly unarmed and unskilled boys? You who prey on the weak without a sign of conscience?
Well, kill me then! Kill me and get it over with!
Kill him, youngster!
Yes, strike!
Get him, Cal!
I give him his life.
What? Huckleberry, may I ask why?
Because he's only a man. Only one highwayman.
What are you, daft?
But there are others, many others, as your son has told me.
What are you blethering about?
He can spread the word, he and his wife, about us, what we did today. We won't allow boys to be pressed any longer, or girls. We won't allow anyone to rob or to steal and to kill as he has done.
We'll do it! We'll do it!
Gods, but I believe you'll make a leader yet. Me, I'd never have thought of that.
Cal, I found... I think I see the dragon!
What?
The dragon! I think it's dead! Oh, it's dead, Cal! It's got licked in a fight! Oh, those scales! Oh, we're rich, Cal! Come on up and...
Come away from there!
Cal! Cal, he's going to get me! Cal, he's going to get me! He's climbing up! Cal, he's climbing!
Kelvin of Rudd, Book 1, Dragon's Gold.
Available now in graphic audio.
You just cannot stay out of trouble for any time at all, can you, boy?
Preacher, you sure have good timing.
I always have. Might have showed up a few minutes earlier, though, since you only left one of the varmints for me to kill.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's The Family Jensen, Number 3, The Violent Land.
Preacher, it is so good to see you again.
Well, it is mighty good to be here.
I'm glad the two of you were able to make it here today. I have a big supper planned.
While you two were flapping your gums, that varmint was about to shoot Preacher in the back.
Oh, no, he wouldn't, Matt. I figured you'd take care of him.
What if I hadn't been paying attention?
Well, I knew you would be. Smoke and meat taught you well enough.
Where'd you say you were from?
Germany. Prussia, to be precise.
What's this about a wagon train?
Baron Friedrich von Hoffmann is our leader. He's taking a large group of settlers to the American states called Wyoming. The Baron has bought a ranch there and intends to establish a town as well.
Sounds like a fellow with big plans.
Oh, help! We gotta do something, Smoke. The Baron's had guards posted, but they won't be expecting something like that.
That's why you've got to get around them and warn everybody at the Raptor 9. Your horse is just as fast as mine or Preacher's, and you can organize a defense. There's no time to waste.
What about the two of you?
We're going to follow them. When they attack the ranch, we'll hit them where they least expect it. From behind.
Damn right we will. We'll have those varmints in a trap right where we want them.
It can't be.
I'm about to ride up there and see for myself. Want me to have the boys saddle a horse for you so you can come along with me?
Damned right I do. I want to see this with my own eyes.
It'll mean going onto that foreigner's range.
I don't give a damn about that. Pick out a dozen men to ride with us and tell them to be ready to fight.
Come on, Bat! We'll cover you!
Available now in graphic audio.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.